It's the Burt Cohen Show. A lot of changes there have been in American history in recent years. We thought we knew who we were. We thought we had a pretty clear definition of America in the world. We are a moral leader, the shining light on the hill. And I'll tell you, when I was growing up, yes, in the 1950s and 60s, it would have been unthinkable to imagine a 21st century in which the U.S. might ever be in the business of torture. Just absolutely unthinkable. Well, as we all know, we have crossed that line a few times, and I'm very pleased to have with us today a person to talk about a nonpartisan independent review of interrogation and detention programs in the years after the September 11th terrorist attacks. It's been done by the Constitution Project. Yes, the Constitution, we all claim fealty to it, but we're going to look at some of the realities of what has happened, where the trail of responsibility lies, and perhaps what can be done about the implementation of actual torture by the United States. I'm very pleased to have with us Alka Pradhan. Are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thanks. And Alka Pradhan is senior researcher and writer with the Constitution Project. Well, let's just get started off here. If you could tell us a little bit about what the Constitution Project is and how did this overarching review come to pass?
Sure. The Constitution Project is a non-governmental organization based here in Washington, D.C., and one of the strengths of the Constitution Project, as opposed to other NGOs, is that it takes a nonpartisan or a bipartisan approach to all of the subjects that it takes on. So the Constitution Project has been around now for about 15 years, and it deals with subjects ranging from voting rights to Guantanamo Bay. So in December 2010, the Constitution Project decided to launch this task force on detainee treatment. And the impetus for the task force was the fact that these things had occurred. The enhanced interrogation techniques had been, the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques had been implemented under the Bush administration for 8 years. And under the Obama administration, seemingly there was not going to be a review of what had happened at that time. And a lot of what changes were being made were being kept classified. So the administration said, and President Obama, I believe, made a statement that we were going to look forward and not backwards, and there didn't seem to be any political will in Congress to do an inquiry into what occurred and what mistakes may have been made and how we can move forward from them. So that was the impetus for the Constitution Project to launch this task force. And the task force itself is made up of 11 members, 11 former government officials, former military. We have judges. We have the former director of the FBI, Bill Sessions, former ambassador Tom Pickering, who most recently led the inquiry into Libya, former Undersecretary for Homeland Security Asa Hutchinson, who's one of the co-chairs, and another former ambassador Jim Jones, who's another co-chair. So those are just a few of the members, and it really does represent a wide spectrum of political, ethical, institutional beliefs. And that was how we approached the issue of detention since 2001.
So it's impossible, really, to have any kind of suggestion that this is any kind of left-wing liberal lynch mob out to get, you know, the good right-wing government. It cannot be said at all. I mean, Asa Hutchinson, tell us about who he is and why his involvement is significant particularly.
Oh, absolutely. Asa, I was actually counsel for the task force, in addition to being one of the researchers and writers of the report. And I worked very closely with Asa on this, and he, of course, was one of the co-chairs. Now, Asa was Undersecretary for Homeland Security under George W. Bush. He knows George W. Bush and other members of the Bush administration very, very well, very personally. And he was a member of Congress before that, a Republican member of Congress. He's currently running for governor of Arkansas on a Republican ticket. So this is someone who has been conservative, who has conservative beliefs, but who approached this with a very open mind. And in our discussions early on with the task force members, we presented them, the staff presented them with the information that we were getting from the interviews and from the research that we were doing. And what Asa said and what all of the members of the task force said, whether conservative or liberal, was that this was clearly, what had occurred in many instances, was clearly torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment sanctioned by the U.S. government at the very highest levels. And that included some of the people who Asa and some of the other conservatives on the panel knew very personally. So this was not an easy conclusion to come to by any means. Now, I know that there may of course be criticism from the right or from other sectors that say this is a liberal bias. But regardless of any any bias that may be impugned to to members of the Constitution Project or others, this was simply a completely bipartisan look at what occurred. And the debates that occurred among the task force members reflected that. They really did approach this looking at just the facts, the reality of what happened on the ground in the theaters of war.
Since the tragedies of 9/11, and I think certainly a thread that will probably go out throughout this interview is, the question, and we'll come back to this toward the end, of what is conservatism, really? I always thought the root word was conserving traditional values and, conserving at the very least the Constitution of the United States. But perhaps we can get into that toward the end. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, I'm talking with Alka Pradhan about a very recently released substantial report about the use of torture, basically, since 9/11. And there are a lot of findings and some recommendations in this very significant report. For example, it says that U.S. forces in many instances used interrogation techniques on detainees that constitute torture. American personnel conducted an even larger number of interrogations that involved cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. Both categories of actions violate U.S. laws and international treaties. Such conduct is directly counter to the values, specific and implied values of the Constitution and our nation. Now, there have always been instances of brutality, oftentimes atrocities, frankly, in just about every war. What is unique about this, what your report found? What's unique about the brutality here?
Well, what's unique about it, Britt, is that this was obviously a response to a terror attack that occurred, the worst terror attack that occurred on our soil. And I think the task force members understood that certainly at the beginning, the importance was to ensure that no other attacks occurred here in the United States. But what was really unique about this was the level to which senior U.S. officials, the extent to which they went in approving the techniques that were used on detainees, the detail to which they went as to how the techniques were to be used, the medical professionals and the lawyers that were involved in parsing the language of the Convention Against Torture and other international treaties that we helped to write come up with definitions that would allow U.S. personnel to engage in acts which, frankly, the task force found rose to the level in many instances exactly of torture and cruel and human degrading treatment. The purpose of all of those lawyers and all of those medical professionals was to sort of carve out exceptions, and unfortunately, that's not what occurred at all. What actually occurred was an official sanction of the use of torture by U.S. personnel in multiple theaters, at Guantanamo Bay, of course, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and at the so-called CIA black sites,
right,
secret prisons that the CIA had abroad.
Is there, I wonder if there's a clear agreement as to what defined tortures. There may be clear international standards, but then again, we have domestic laws. Is it settled law as to what defines torture?
Certainly. We have not only the Convention Against Torture, but the United States adopted the language of the Convention Against Torture in our own torture statute and war crime statutes, which talk about what constitutes torture and what constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Now, that said, admittedly, there is necessarily ambiguity in when you're talking about what rises to the level of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and what rises to the level of torture. So what we looked at, and that's where a lot of the room for debate comes in, and unfortunately many advocates of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques have been able to use the ambiguity in the language to sort of push that agenda of, well, it may not have risen to the level of torture. So in order to really put this issue to rest, what the task force did is look at all of the techniques that were approved, first individually, such as sleep deprivation, stress positions, use of nudity, forced nudity, food deprivation, use of cold temperatures, slapping, beating, of course, the infamous waterboarding. We looked at each of them individually and then looked at how they were actually applied. Most of these techniques were never applied on their own. They were applied in combination. They were applied over long periods of time, and some, in many instances, much longer than they may have been approved for formally. And what the task force concluded was that in the instances, in the cases that we looked at, in the very, very many cases that we looked at, the use of these techniques absolutely rose to the level of torture. For example, if you look at the technique of sleep deprivation, so an advocate of using these techniques might say, look, you know, I'm sleep deprived all the time. I have to get up early for work. I only got 3 hours of sleep. That's sleep deprivation. I don't consider myself to be tortured. The way this was actually used, for instance, by the CIA, was a specific detainee was kept awake for days at a time, up to a week, in freezing temperatures, completely nude, in a diaper, because it was adjudged that allowing him to use the toilet would interfere with the sleep deprivation method, with his hands shackled. So that clearly rises to the level of torture. So that's one of the conclusions
that the task force
came to.
Yeah. Now, torture isn't something, brand new. We certainly saw it used in other countries, our enemies specifically, during the Second World War. But if you look at a little bit of American, that's what we were fighting against. That's what people, Americans united behind, to fight against these people who would do such things. Mm-hmm. In the past, I wonder about past presidents on torture. For example, the turn of the last century, the war on the Philippines, somehow called the Spanish-American War. Mm-hmm. Did the president not know of the routine use of torture, that there was, in fact, waterboarding in that war? Or are you aware of this history?
Well, you know, we didn't look at that in detail, but, you know, we do know that that previous administrations may have been aware of the use of torture by U.S. personnel. But there's a big difference between being aware of such use and actually officially sanctioning it. And what we saw here is, and we have all of the blueprints for this and the memos that were released from the Office of Legal Counsel, is not just official sanction, but looking for ways in which to sanction this treatment.
Interesting.
And that was something that was really new to those of us looking at it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of questions as to the chain of command, how this happened. And certainly throughout our history, it's always been really convenient to have some, you know, lesser person in the chain of command to blame everything on him, and seems to be always a male, quite frankly, and to erase any culpability at the top. And I wonder, first off, looking at this aspect of it, can it be said that the Bush administration, which was largely responsible for this, the use of torture, can it be said that they acted on good faith in a desperate effort to prevent more attacks like 9/11?
You know, Bert, that's a great question, and I think that the task force members approached it in that way, approached it from the assumption that the administration considered the country to be facing an existential threat after September 11th, and I think we all understand how frightening that was. That said, when you start to get 2, 3, 5, 7 years away from September 11th, 2001, and you're still using techniques like this, you're still rendering detainees secretly to places where they're being tortured for informational purposes, when you're still holding people in indefinite detention, you begin to question what the threat you're looking at is and whether that same panic, whether that same existential threat justifies the means that you're using.
Mm. And I don't have the exact quote, but there was something, I believe it was Benjamin Franklin, who said something about people who want freedom but are willing to sacrifice security will probably get neither. And certainly one can see how the existential threat was perceived by a heck of a lot of people to be real. And we're talking about not just freedom. We want to get the bad guys. But the use of, I mean, transforming us into a security state and justifying anything and everything to get the bad guys certainly is a dangerous door for us to have open. And looking at the culpability, the chain of command, I want to continue with that. It was said of the government lawyers, and this is an interesting part of the findings of the report of which we speak, that government lawyers in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel did some very creative legal acrobatics to enable the enhanced interrogation. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, their role, and the position they found themselves in. It's a very difficult, I imagine, situation. Were they directed? Did they direct themselves? What do you know about the government lawyers and the Office of Legal Counsel on enabling the interrogations?
Certainly. Well, I mean, we talk about this in detail in the report, and I believe Chapter 4 of the report, The Legal Process of the Federal Government After September 11th, and we go through the progression of where the people at the top of the administration decided that they were not going to apply the Geneva Conventions, and afterwards then went to the Office of Legal Counsel for a series of opinions as to which interrogation techniques would be acceptable for use. And one of the first memos that came out, of course, was specifically for CIA use of techniques on a detainee named Abu Zubaydah. And what was happening here is the CIA or the White House were going to the Office of Legal Counsel and saying, you know, we would like to use these techniques. Here's what we would like to accomplish. how can we do that? So, you know, there's an understanding that the Office of Legal Counsel was sort of creative, looking at the legal framework in a creative manner to allow the administration to accomplish those goals. And that was one of the conclusions of the task force, which also, I believe, in one of its findings, recommended, or in one of its recommendations, said that the Office of Legal Counsel needed to be sort of separate in a way from the administration, insofar as it interprets the law as it stands, not as an aspirational body.
So it sounds to me, tell me if I'm hearing this right, that mm-hmm. that they found some, you know, eager beaver lawyers working for the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, and is it correct that the lawyers were really directed, give us some cover, you guys have some degree of independence, find some way we can do this torture? Is that accurate? Do you think is that consistent with the findings?
That's certainly one of the findings of the task force. Now, I don't believe I don't believe it was ever stated we want to torture detainees.
Right.
At the outset, but certainly they wanted all of the tools, as Vice President Cheney has said, they wanted all tools available to be able to interrogate these detainees, and unfortunately, many of those tools, most of the enhanced interrogation techniques that were eventually approved and were asked for by the administration and by the CIA, did indeed rise to the level of torture.
And again, if you just tuned in, we're talking about a new report, very powerful report on findings of the use of torture by U.S. government officials, and looking at the chain of command. What about military leaders' culpability? What do we know about that? Or is it more the civilian government?
You know what? I'm glad you asked that, because, again, this is something that's very important that comes out in our report in great detail, and I think it's worth everyone reading these chapters of the report. It's important to note that the heads of the military opposed the suspension of the Geneva Conventions by and large, and they opposed use of these techniques, and they continue to do so now, precisely because these techniques place U.S. personnel at risk abroad. So for those advocates of these techniques, one questions whether they have taken into account the fact that those personnel who would actually be carrying out those techniques are exactly the ones who do not want to, who know that the situation on the ground is such that if they engage in these techniques, they open themselves up to dangerous situations. We have, for instance, an interview with Alberto Mora, the former general counsel of the Navy, who he describes in Chapter 1 of the report, Detention at Guantanamo, how he found out what techniques were being used at Guantanamo Bay for interrogation of the detainees there early on, and his reaction was absolute horror. And he went back to administration officials and protested and had conversations with them, and was almost led off the scent at certain points and told that it would be dealt with, and you know, nobody was quite sure who had authorized them. And found out later that, in fact, they had been authorized at the very highest levels. So I think it's very important to underscore that this was never an idea of the highest-ranking military officials. The judge advocate generals all opposed this.
That is very impressive. And, you know, the report notes that some former senior government officials say that the use of these arguably torturous techniques did in fact yield valuable intelligence that resulted in operational and strategic successes. These officials mm-hmm. say that the evidence of such success may not be disclosed for reasons of national security. What about this point? Has this point been made convincingly enough? Does this assertion depend on we, the people, taking a leap of faith and trusting their government? I mean, they say that that it was useful, that it was worthwhile, and they justify that. And what about that argument?
You know, that leap of faith is exactly what the task force concluded was no longer acceptable. In the investigation, we looked concretely at those claims that are made really by just a handful of individuals in the former administration, and frankly, made by those individuals who have the most to gain by making that assertion because they were the ones who approved those techniques in the first place. And what the task force concluded is they looked at specific situations. You know, one of the situations that's been touted by former officials is, for instance, the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, of course, was instrumental in September 11th and was rendered by the CIA waterboarded in Poland, subjected to some of these techniques. And one of the assertions that's been made is that information from him and information from several others may have contributed to the capture of bin Laden. And so what we look at are situations like this, specific situations, and we broke it down, and the task force concluded that really based on what we know, and there is a great deal of public source information about this at this point, based on the timelines and the people spoken to and what we know about this, there is no reason, there's absolutely no reason to believe that that was the case, that the use of the enhanced interrogation techniques on these individuals did concretely lead to the capture of bin Laden or anything like that. Now, what we did find, now the task force acknowledges that, you know, we did not have access to classified information. We did not have subpoena power. So there may be information regarding useful information gained from such techniques, but we would then point readers to statements from Senators Feinstein and McCain from the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. Now, they've just concluded an in-depth investigation that's complementary to ours because while they didn't conduct interviews and they did not use public source information, they had access to all of the classified files. And their conclusion was exactly the same as the task force's, which was that there is simply no evidence that these techniques yielded useful information. What we do outline in the report are instances where such techniques led to false or misleading information.
Sure.
And one of the well-known cases, of course, is that of a detainee named Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, who was being interrogated using lawful means, and I believe that he did give up useful information under that interrogation, but was then subsequently rendered by the CIA to Egypt to be interrogated, and where he was tortured, where they knew he would be tortured, and under those circumstances, gave up information regarding the link between Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction, which was one of the major pieces of information relied upon by the Bush administration in going into Iraq. So, you know, here we have counterexamples to show that torture at best produces, it may produce useful information, but it also produces false and misleading information. And every interrogator, every specialist in this that we spoke to says that it is simply not effective. It's simply, there's no way of knowing what is true and what is not. And so it actually wastes a great deal of time, in addition to being completely illegal and immoral.
And yet it has its defenders.
Exactly. And so what I believe the task force would say here, and what we would say, is that it's no longer acceptable to just make that assertion that, you trust us, we know that this has worked in the past. Every assertion must be proven. And unfortunately, these individuals who claim that the torture worked or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment worked have not proven those assertions. And I believe that the American public deserves to know exactly why they're saying that.
Oh, so many different threads to follow up on here. I'll start with the people who defend the use of torture most aggressively. one can understand their reason for defending it. These former officials have a substantial reputation and quite possibly legal stake in being right. I wonder if you could talk about that. Might not they face potential prosecution themselves?
Well, you know, but the task force members did not approach this as prosecutors. Of course, we did not have subpoena power. We did not have access to classified information. So the question of whether they would be open for prosecution is ultimately a matter for the Department of Justice. Certainly, they bear moral responsibility for the decisions that were made. And what we do outline in the report are the attempts that have been made abroad to hold certain administration officials right. legally responsible for those decisions. There have been indictments issued against the former vice president, the former president, former secretary of defense, just to name a few. So, and of course, most perhaps in the most recent ongoing case is one in Italy against a large number of CIA officials involved in a rendition there. So certainly attempts have been made abroad. Here in the United States, what the task force is concerned about is that the Convention Against Torture imposes a legal obligation on the United States, which we undertook, having helped conceive of the convention, and then signing and ratifying it. We undertook this legal obligation to, at the very least, to investigate all allegations of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And task force is concerned that this sort of accounting, this sort of review, has not yet occurred.
Well, what about the Senate Intelligence Committee? They're supposed to be looking into it, and I guess there was a question about releasing their findings to make sure that, that nothing would endanger national security. What's the status of that? Is there any kind of move to disclose their information, and is there pressure not to disclose their findings?
Well, I would imagine there is immense pressure not to disclose the findings, especially if, as they've said, one of their conclusions was that these techniques actually were not effective. But that said, there's quite a movement here in Washington among the various non-governmental organizations and other groups to declassify the whatever from the report can be declassified without endangering national security. Now, we're talking about evidence and reports and information that date back to 2001. And so the task force has called for declassification of the report. And, you know, it's our belief that certain parts of that information that are clearly backdated to, you know, to the early 2000s, you know, certainly should be released and must be released in order for the American public to understand what was done in their name.
And what do you think the likelihood is?
Well, you know, we've heard indications that there is an attempt being made to first declassify perhaps the summary of the report, and then down the line perhaps declassify the full report. But unfortunately, we don't know what the status of that is. Of course, we add our voices. The task force has added its voice to others calling for declassification of the report from the senators at the helm.
Don't tell me that politics is interfering with getting to the truth. No, I'm shocked. I'm shocked. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Alka Pradhan, senior researcher and writer for the Constitution Project, which just released a very, very significant report, got an international attention, a clearly nonpartisan report on the use of torture by the United States. It's been kind of buried by events of, you know, April 15th and April 16th, but very, very significant. And among the findings, there's a lot of findings in this, is that, and this I find really interesting, military psychologists and military physicians were instructed that they were relieved of the obligation to comply with non-military ethical principles. And in some cases, their military roles were redefined as non-health professional combatants. Dr. Mengele, I presume? I mean, tell us about that. That's pretty shocking.
About the military.
The doctors being redirected to eject their ethical principles and possibly to become actually involved in enhanced interrogation techniques. That's pretty. Mm-hmm. That's pretty frightening.
It is. It is. And the role of medical professionals, which is one of the significant chapters in our report, is something that we believe has not been looked at in detail before this and is really important to understanding how these techniques were used and implemented and in a really kind of horrifying manner. I believe every medical association, professional association, except for the American Psychological Association, after having understood how medical professionals were used in interrogations, has denounced the use of medical professionals and they've all stated that it would be counter to their values as medical professionals. And you know what we found and what we talk about in detail in the report is how the administration, after having established what they considered to be a legal basis for using these techniques, brought in medical professionals as a way of sort of safeguarding the use of these techniques and having them monitor detainees under the use of these techniques. Now, unfortunately, when they're using these techniques, whether they're being monitored or not, they still constitute cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment at best, and in many cases, torture. So instead of having medical professionals, adjudge the methods and determine and stop them for being torture, cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment, what you actually had was sort of a perverse situation where medical professionals are overseeing the use of torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. It was a very, very unfortunate situation that they were put in.
Yeah, the word perverse seems entirely appropriate. It's just unbelievable that this would be happening in the U.S. We've seen this in other countries which we considered our enemies. Now, what about force feeding? Is that considered torture? Did it happen a lot? And follow-up to that, is force feeding not fairly common in U.S. prisons?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, because there is some ambiguity regarding force feeding. Now, under international law, force feeding is considered to be counter to the rights of an individual undergoing a hunger strike, because the assumption is that a competent individual undergoing a hunger strike is within his rights to do so and should not be force-fed. Now, in the United States, we have a different practice, and you alluded to the practice within prisons of force feeding. There is such a practice of feeding individuals who may be in some medical trouble or maybe suffering medical effects from hunger strikes. What is interesting and what is different about the way force feeding is used at Guantanamo Bay, and this was, again, one of the findings of the task force, is that force feeding at Guantanamo Bay uses different methods. They use a restraint chair that completely immobilizes the detainee. And they began using these chairs, I believe, in 2006 when hunger strikes became very prevalent. The detainees have complained that it makes them feel like animals. Now, the military has said that the use of these specific restraint chairs is necessary to prevent their personnel and medical professionals from being assaulted by the detainees. But that doesn't really logically follow, because if the detainees are weak enough or are suffering such ill effects to require force feeding, then it doesn't stand to reason that they would be able to assault military personnel or the medical professionals treating them. So, you know, there's some confusion about that. The idea of force feeding, we recognize, and the task force recognizes that the United States has an interest in keeping detainees alive. No one wants detainees to die, certainly not on our watch. And, you know, all of the improvements that have been made at Guantanamo Bay have been made to prevent that. But that said, the way force feeding is occurring now at Guantanamo, where, a tube is inserted fairly forcefully using these restraint chairs, it simply is inhuman, and it's not something that the task force found was acceptable practice. When you talk about U.S. prisons, I think there was only one U.S. prison which was the Supermax in Colorado, which we found used restraint chairs at all. Restraint chairs are, you know, like this, are simply not used at the prison. So uh-huh. There's a very different protocol. Oh, so defenders of force feeding who say that, you know, we use them all the time, we use it all the time in the United States, are talking about something very different than the force feeding that's going on at Guantanamo Bay.
Interesting. And on the subject of medical care, it sounded like from the report I gathered some interesting internal debates within the International Red Cross regarding what they knew and should or shouldn't say. That sounds like an interesting story in and of itself. I wonder if you could tell us about the internal debates within the International Red Cross on these issues.
Absolutely. One of the aspects of our report, again, that we believe has not been talked about is the role of the International Committee on the Red Cross. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward. The ICRC does not generally publicize its findings or its conclusions. In fact, its operations depend on that sort of secrecy. So they're allowed into countries and they're allowed full access. They demand full access to detainees on the condition that they speak only to the government involved. That sort of discretion is how the ICRC operates. Regardless, during the course of operations at Guantanamo Bay, a couple of memos were released we're not sure exactly who released them, but they were released that delineated the ICRC's conclusions about what was occurring at Guantanamo Bay. And one of those memos was fairly shocking. It discussed the treatment of 14 high-value detainees who were brought to Guantanamo after being flown to various sites around the world and interrogated by the CIA. And it talked about the treatment that they claimed to have been subjected to during their interrogations by the CIA and their treatment at Guantanamo, which the ICRC judged to be very, very harsh. So we look at those memos, and the task force also looked at interviews that the staff conducted with, for instance, the former head of the ICRC delegation to Guantanamo Bay, Albert Shimkus, which is in our very first chapter on detention at Guantanamo Bay, and the challenges that he faced in dealing with the military and with the Department of Defense when he first visited Guantanamo Bay, including the fact that the ICRC was not given full access to detainees, which is one of the conditions of their operations.
Oh, my. Very tangled web that's woven there, clearly. Is it clear, you know, after looking at the findings and doing this report, is it clear what the legal chain of authority was that enabled this? What does the report conclude about the process of decision-making regarding the use of torture? Is there some clarity that's come out of that?
It seems fairly straightforward, and it's a very, very long, as you can imagine, the report is quite substantial. But it's worth, I believe, going into some of these chapters in depth and looking at how these decisions were made from the very top down, as opposed to what has been claimed previously that these were just a few bad apples among our military personnel. You know, and a few people here and there have been court-martialed and convicted of abusing detainees, but it's clear, it's absolutely crystal clear that the responsibility for these decisions was made at the very top, and it made its way down. And there's, in several of our interviews with military officials, a concept kept coming up called force drift. And the concept basically is that when these techniques were approved at the very top, there was an understanding, there should have been an understanding, that what would then occur is the drifting of these techniques over over theaters, and the expansion of the techniques such that, you know, if, for instance, one technique, just as an example, if a technique was authorized under certain very strict circumstances, that would lapse at a certain point as you go down the chain of command. And when you start getting military personnel on the ground in Abu Ghraib believing that certain techniques are sanctioned without formal instructions or very detailed instructions, you have this concept of force drift that comes into play, where the actions and the techniques used get worse and worse and worse until you see the kind of abuse that we saw at Abu Ghraib, and you see detainees being not only abused but killed in detention.
That is a very crucial point. And what if the leaders who are responsible, frankly, get away with it? What if they do not acknowledge that the authorization and practice of torture and cruelty after September 11th was a grave, at the very least, error, if not worse? What if they're going to get away with this? And hasn't Obama said something sort of like, well, just move on, put this behind us?
That's exactly what the president said when he came into office, is that we're just going to look forward, we're not going to look backwards. And what the task force believes is that would be a very serious mistake. This is not ancient history. These are events that continue to have consequences in our relations, not just with detainees, of course, but with our allies abroad and with enemies abroad. We talk about this in detail. Again, there's an entire chapter called Effects and Consequences of the Detention Program, and we break it into three portions. We talk about the legal and political consequences, and there we have, of course, the indictments abroad and the soured relations with allies, the fact that certain allies have actually rather let certain high-value detainees that they've captured go then hand them over to American forces because of the fear that they would be abused or tortured.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the effects on U.S. personnel, U.S. military personnel, the people who we should be doing everything to support, have suffered in many cases, you know, instances of post-traumatic stress disorder and other breakdowns because of the acts that they were instructed to perform on detainees. And then finally, of course, we have the consequences for the detainees themselves, the former detainees. The task force was concerned that we release those detainees who we release without any sort of just release to either third countries or their home countries, without any sort of support network, without, you know, checking to see if they have the ability to earn any money to reintegrate into society. And there is a very real concern that could actually lead to recidivism or engagement by these individuals for the first time, since we know, again, one of the things that we know from the report and from many other reports is that many of these individuals whom we captured may not have been engaged in acts hostile to the United States.
Yeah, it's not helping us worldwide, that's for sure. I wonder how bad the damage to our international reputation is. I mean, certainly there's a lot of people on the right who somehow call themselves conservatives, which is beyond me, but who say that, well, to heck with what the world thinks, we're going to go it on our own. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
I mean, unfortunately, that's not how the world works. And you know, these handful of individuals who keep saying this over and over again, one of whom I believe criticized the report for being divorced from reality, unfortunately are not looking at reality. They're not looking at the very real effects that these techniques and these policies have had on our relationships with, I mean, forget those interests that are hostile to the United States.
Right.
They're not looking at the effects that these have had on our allies. I mean, our allies in Europe and elsewhere are now being castigated for their involvement with our detention program. There are cases now being filed and decided against our allies, Poland and Lithuania and Romania, at the European Court of Human Rights. There are cases going forward in England against former officials there. So this is an ongoing set of consequences, and it will continue to go on. And the very least that this country can do is acknowledge what occurred in the name of the American people in order to move forward. I believe that would go a very long way. In fact, one of the things that that the task force did is two task force members, Asa Hutchinson and Brigadier General David Irvine, who is a former interrogator himself, spent his entire career conducting interrogations, went to England to meet with several former detainees and learn about their experiences. And I accompanied them on this trip. And one of the things that we had, a very, very long, very difficult conversation with these individuals who were first held abroad in Afghanistan and then were sent to Guantanamo Bay and were abused there. And at the end of the conversation, General Irvine, and this is in the report in the consequences section, said that I said something to the effect that I suspect that my country is at the very beginning of a process of being able to say that we're sorry. And the response from the detainees was that, you know, that's what we're looking for.
Right.
That's what everyone is looking for. And they said that General Irvine was the most senior person to have ever said anything like that to them from the United States. So clearly, there's a lot to be gained from making that acknowledgement. Whether apologies or prosecutions or anything else are down the line, that's not for the task force to say. But the task force was clear that there's a lot to be gained from acknowledging what happened.
But that's not the macho thing to do. And it does make an awful lot of sense. And I'm remembering back in 1970, I want to know what Congress may be doing about this and the Obama administration. Back in 1970, when the U.S. was waging a clearly illegal war in Cambodia, Congress said, no, you have to stop. Congress actually asserted its responsibility and its legal authority to do something about it. Is Congress gonna do something now, do you think? Do you see any indication of pressure coming from Congress to do the right thing?
Well, it's very difficult to say with Congress. Of course, the task force has recommended that Congress look at this in detail, but perhaps one of the most important things among the 20-some findings and recommendations that the task force issued is the overuse of classified information. And one thing Congress can do and the administration can do is end the overuse of the state secrets privilege and the overclassification of anything associated with the U.S. detention program. Because there is a belief and there is an understanding that this overclassification has occurred because of a need to sort of hide the details. And, you know, we believe that declassification of a lot of this would go a long ways towards the public understanding what happened. Now, of course, in addition to that, there is, again, the Senate Select Intelligence Committee report, which is going to be absolutely crucial to that understanding. And there is a call by the task force to declassify that as well.
Yeah, it seems like we just steadfastly don't want to look in the mirror and see what we've done. We just want to sweep it under the rug. The report says something, pretty strong statement. It says democracy and torture cannot peacefully coexist. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's a truism if I've heard one. And the task force just wanted to be very, very clear about that because, unfortunately, things have been done in the name of this country that have been justified over and over again, and they wanted to be very clear that this is not something that we stand for. The United States does not stand for torture, does not stand for cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. The United States helped write many of the laws internationally that deal with these concepts. It's not a new concept that torture is illegal.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a democracy like ours, which is an inspiration around the world, you simply cannot have the practice of torture, the practice of cruel and human and degrading treatment, which then necessitates a cover-up from the very public that elects these officials into office.
And I kind of like democracy. You know, I'm not giving up on it yet. It very fascinating, very powerful, very important report. If people want to take a look at it, to what site can you point them on that internet?
The full report is available online at www.detaineetaskforce.org. And we have the full report up there, in addition to the press that's been written about it and biographies of the task force members and the staff.
And is also just the constitutionproject.org. What's that website exactly?
Yes, exactly. The task force was convened by the Constitution Project, which ran the whole project, and that's constitutionproject.org.
Thank you so much. Maybe people can make it happen and bring about some winds of change that really need to come. Thank you very much, Alka Pradhan, with the Constitution Project. We can't let this one go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Bert.
All right. We the people, we got to make it happen here. I mean, this is just, the things that have been done in our name are not helping America. We got to make those winds of change happen. Thanks for listening.